sublime to the demented.
I don't even know why I'm wasting my breath, but what the hell? Humanity is getting sick. You don't understand me. You are not expected to. You are not capable of it. I am beyond your experience. I am beyond good and evil. Legions of the night breed. Repeat not the errors of my father and show no mercy. I will be avenged. Lucifer dwells within us all.
So that was what I consider the devil himself.
You know? I didn't like it. I'll be honest with you, man.
Dude, we've been trying to work on this one for a couple of weeks and catching every snag we can along the way. And then just dealing with this guy is really getting to us.
Yeah, yeah. So this is a different one for us. We've been starting to get some feedback from you guys, and we had a few requests for this. We decided we'd follow and, you know, please you guys, see what was up, and dig into the Night Stalker, Richard Ramirez.
This dude is a grade A jerk.
Yes, a douchebag.
It's by far one of the worst human beings I believe I've ever come across.
Yes, and there's another reason I was glad people brought this up and asked us to do this. From my research and being a big podcast fan myself, I've heard way too many female podcasters swoon over this bag of feces.
I don't get it.
I don't get it
either.
But
you know what? We can relate. In life, I can relate somebody to this guy, without a doubt.
Oh.
Like, there is people I've come across that reminds me of this guy, and the girls will just be all over him, and it makes no sense.
Yeah. But there will be no crushing, no justifying, nothing from us.
Unless I'm crushing on you.
Oh.
Yeah.
So, without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Daniel. We're going to get lost in thought, guys.
Richard Ramirez, which is one of the country's top serial killers on the list.
One of the most well-known.
Well-known, anyway. Without a doubt. And but he was born in 1960 in El Paso, Texas. He was he had a couple of siblings. But his childhood might have led into what happened to him in the future. His mom actually worked at a boat factory. And there were chemicals that she dealt with every day. And it caused birth defects, not only in Richard, but in each one of his siblings as well.
Oh, no.
And so, like, he was born in El Paso, Texas. And he was the youngest. It was Mexican immigrants. It was Mercedes and Julian Ramirez. And they had five kids. So he had five siblings.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Four of the siblings were also born with a birth defect. So it was all five of them. And it was born deformities, mental delays. It was a number of things. And it was the chemical fumes while she was working at that boat factory that is in theory, what caused it.
Yeah.
But on top of that, man, when the dude was 2 years old, a dresser fell on top of his head. And it actually caused a laceration. It was like 30 stitches across his forehead when he was only 2 years old.
That's a big scar for a little guy.
Right, man. Dude, 5 years old. He was hit in the head with a swing by his sister. His sister literally grabbed the swing, man, and just tossed it as hard as she could. At 5 years old, it caught him right in the head, knocked him smooth out.
I want to feel bad, but at the same time, I'm kind of like, what did little Richie do?
But you know what? They say this. You know, they say that this might have caused, you know, the problems in the future, whatever. Man, I was dropped on my head as a kid, surprisingly.
Not surprised. But
yeah.
I can tell.
Dude, no joke, I fell out of my dad's truck at a church, landed on some gravel, and literally cracked my head open to the point where I had staples. I still have a giant slit on the side of my head from it.
I'm going to look at that later, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes, I will show you. It is cool.
Might even put it on Instagram if he'll let me.
But that wasn't it. So my sister always, like, she'll get mad when I say this. I'm going to go ahead and toss it out. But my sister, she actually, I was reading her diary when I was like 4. She picked me up. She would have been 12 at the time. And threw me head first into the wall while I still had staples in my head, re-split my head open. So, I mean, don't get me wrong. It may be, I'm a little bit goofier than I normally, you know, should have been, whatever. But I didn't turn out to be a serial killer is what I'm getting at.
Catfish the crash test dummy over there.
Yeah, man. You know, I didn't turn into a serial killer, though. So I don't really get it. It just doesn't. It
if
don't
you
compete,
do,
man.
I would like the exclusive interview.
Yes, absolutely. Oh, yeah, I got you, buddy.
So at the age of 6, he began to have seizures and was diagnosed with temporal lobe epilepsy. It was also at this age where he began to witness his dad, who he described as being a very violent man, beat his older brother, whose name was Reuben.
And Ramirez was raised in a strict Catholic household. Went on to become an altar boy in church.
No way.
I didn't know that about him
Ramirez,
either.
Ramirez, the altar boy?
Yes.
Nah. Okay. See, this is what corrupted him. Forget the being dropped on his head. The altar boy in the Catholic church, that's what messed this dude up.
Yeah, man. His classmates thought that he seemed a bit weird or odd. But overall, he was a pretty good student. Like, he wasn't a horrible kid. I mean, he had a little bit of temper issues, but, I mean, they said he was kind of a normal kid, just odd. And he began isolating himself around 9, though. And then that's when he kind of become kind of a loner.
Okay. So, at age 12, he was introduced to his cousin Mike and began to hang out with him.
Now, this guy was also a jerk.
This is where I think Richard's bad side comes from. And if you let us get into it and explain, I think you might agree with me on it as well.
Oh yeah. Well, you know, 12, you know, we're developing, we're learning, we're growing. It's that adolescent period that's really important.
Yeah. Very easily modeled and molded and shaped. Right.
And, you know, and looking at the profiles of serial killers and getting more into the psychology of it. And that's something I've noticed. There was usually some trauma around this age point.
Yeah. So to get away from his dad, Richard started sleeping in cemeteries. And by the age of 12, he was hanging out with his older cousin, Miguel, who went by Mike, that had an extremely violent streak as well. Now, Mike had recently returned from fighting in the Vietnam War, and he sort of would tell, you know, Richie what it was like over there. And he'd give really gross and gory stories. He'd talk about killing people and the way that they did it, and he would show this with graphic, and I mean graphic, probably Polaroid photos of torture and mutilation that he had inflicted on several Vietnamese women.
Right, and this was, this was rape, beatings. He beheaded some of these women.
Yeah, some of the worst things you could picture and think about when you hear of the horrors of the Vietnam War, you know, committed by American soldiers. Here's Mike, you know,
right,
Mike's
that guy. And you got to think, 12 years old, you know, where we was looking at Playboy at 12 years old, you know, he snuck in and found a Playboy.
I'm not even going to think about what he was looking at.
Yeah, I mean, he's literally looking at decapitated, raped women.
Yeah.
You can't get worse than that.
And when Mike showed Richard these photographs, it actually turned Richard on. You know, so from a young age, this is what aroused him.
Man, that was setting him up, dude.
Yeah, and things are going to spiral from here. One of his first things where he did, you know, a bad thing, he threw a rock through a neighbor's window, and his mother just kind of shrugged it off. She didn't really care. She didn't discipline him, you know, just kind of whatever. And later on at 13, Richard witnessed Mike shoot his wife, and she died. Her name was Jessie. She was shot in the face point blank with a revolver.
Right, and in front of a 13-year-old.
Yeah, and he witnessed that, and I guess it probably turned him on. So he began to get worse and worse. And the years followed, he learned how to pick locks, open and break in windows. He began to stalk and kill small animals, including rabbits, different birds, coyotes, probably cats and dogs as well.
Yeah, you know, that's one thing with serial killers. If you look at their early childhood, there's usually mutilation and killing of and destructive, especially when it comes to animals.
Yeah, very early on. That's how it starts. You know, things start escalating. He began to steal and break into homes, and eventually he was caught and sent to a Texas youth camp for juvenile delinquents. Now, as we know, when you go into jail, you go in with an amateur's degree, and you come out with a master's. So while in there, he began to hone his skills.
That's where he actually learned how to break into homes a lot better.
Cover his tracks so he wouldn't get caught, you know.
That's right.
Those kids just sit there and talk about being bad and glorifying it and, you know, bragging what they can do and what you can do, you know, how to get away with it.
Yeah, he literally was practicing at that point on how to get better at it. And he did until he just got stupid.
Yeah. Now, he dropped out of high school and at the age of 22, we're going to skip ahead a little bit and move on. He moved to California where he would settle down. And I believe if a lot of you guys are interested in this, it's because of the current Netflix documentary that's out. And this is really where that's going to pick up. So if you want to have something extra and follow along, if you happen to not have watched it, maybe it's a good time to do so. Possible trigger warning. Those guys really get into and get off on crime scene photos. And I'm a former EMT. I have walked into some nasty, traumatic stuff. And there were a few times where I was even taken back a little bit, like, all right, they're glorifying, you know?
Yeah, can you believe his uncle actually got away with it?
Yeah, did he?
Yeah, he got away with it. Oh, yeah. They played Insanity, and they put him in a mental hospital.
Well, I mean, the dude was crazy as hell.
Yep.
So, let's get started. I'm going to turn it over to Catfish, and, man, let him set the tone, you guys.
Man, 1984, ooh, year I was born.
You'd have the hair going, Camaros and Firebirds with the T-tops off, denim jackets.
Oh, yeah, got to wear the
perm,
denim,
baby.
Big hair at Los Angeles.
REO Speedway.
Yeah. So, I mean, he's living it up, man, and he was the cool guy. So he moved, he was in California at this point, but that is actually where the major stuff actually started was in 84. He murdered a 9-year-old Chinese American in the basement of a hotel where he was living at. And he had a tendency of bouncing from hotel to hotel. And he raped and beat this girl before stabbing her to death. And then he ended up, if I'm right, did he hang her from a pipe?
Yes, yes. Now, this should be said that in 2016, officials disclosed the fact that there was other DNA evidence and a possible second suspect during this rape and murder of this poor little girl. So that's pretty creepy to think that there could have possibly been another half of the Night Stalker crew at one time that is never got punished, never got caught.
And Ramirez never, you know, the reason I think Ramirez never came out and actually said who was there with him, it wasn't that he was trying not to rat on somebody. I think the guy's a piece of crap and just didn't want to know the full story. He didn't want people to know what exactly happened.
No, I think he wanted all the credit.
You know? Yeah.
I didn't want it to be the Night Stalkers, you know, where it's multiple men causing this, you know, torment and, you know, harassment of this community. It's one man, you know, and that makes him seem like so much more, even though he's a pussy who preyed on the weak.
Yeah. And, but, you know, the Night Stalker actually wasn't his first given name.
What was his first given name, buddy?
They experimented. It was right before Night Stalker. They had actually called him the Walk-In Killer.
Oh, wow.
The Valley Intruder and the Screen Door Intruder.
Ah, the Screen Door Intruder.
Yeah, but finally, the Night Stalker actually stuck because it had that whole vampire-y type vibe to it.
They should have called him the Stanky Teeth Intruder.
Dude, they said he actually stunk.
Oh, I bet he look at this. Look at him.
Like, these women that are sitting here like, oh, man, he was so cute. And they're, like idolizing this guy. Legitimately, like, there are multiple people that said that you could smell him before you seen him.
What kind of rotten eggs you got going on inside of you that's got your biological clock saying, oh, no, he's just misunderstood.
Yeah.
No, oh, you're messed up.
Yeah, remind me later to discuss his teeth after we get into the trial. Because that really aggravated me.
It looks like fence posts. And they got perfect spacing.
Yeah. Guys, what ugly dude. I'm so tired of seeing his face. I'm done when we get done with this. I'm never gonna watch anything else with this
guy. I'm not listening to you guys' requests no more.
About him.
Just kidding.
Yeah.
Just kidding. But next episode we're doing something we want. It's gonna be fun too.
All right. So where are we at?
Yeah,
let's see. 1985, man. Take it over.
Next, on June 28th, 1984, 79-year-old Jenny Venko was found brutally murdered in her apartment. Her apartment was located in the Glasso Park area of Los Angeles. She had been stabbed repeatedly while she was sleeping in her bed, and Ramirez had slit her throat so deeply that he almost cut her head off. She was nearly decapitated.
Jesus.
Ramirez's fingerprint was found on a mesh screen that he removed to gain access through an open window. So he's sloppy, and he's beginning to leave things behind already.
Yeah, and he went from a 9-year-old to a 79-year-old.
Yeah.
This is something you do not regularly see.
And then from a 9-year-old to a 79-year-old, down to a 22-year-old on March 17th of 1985. Her name was Maria Hernandez, and she was shot in the face with a .22 caliber handgun outside of her home in Rosemead, California, as she was pulling up into her garage. She survived the initial gunshot because it ricocheted off of the keys that she was holding in her hands, and she lifted it up in a defensive position at the right time. Now, inside the house, her roommate, named Dale Yoshi Okazaki, age 34, had heard the gunshot and was crouching behind a counter when he looked up and saw Ramirez enter the kitchen. I'm sorry, when she looked up and saw Ramirez enter the kitchen. When she raised her head and poked above the counter, Ramirez shot her once in the forehead, killing her instantly.
Jesus Christ.
Within an hour, just an hour of the Rosemead home invasion, Ramirez pulled 30-year-old, I hope I don't butcher your name too much, Sai Lan Yu, who went by Veronica. He pulled her out of her car in Monterey Park, shot her twice with the same .22 caliber handgun, and then ran and then fled. She was pronounced dead at the hospital. Those two murders and the attempted third in one single day is what began to attract such attention to this story.
Man, you know, and the thing is, I'm wondering if him targeting the Asian Americans had something to do with being 12, 13 years old and seeing the pictures of the Vietnamese women being tortured.
Oh, man, I'm just now putting two and two together.
Yeah, I've been thinking about that through this whole thing. Reed.
Now, through a little bit of information they had, they dubbed the attacker, who was described as curly-haired with bulging eyes and wide, spaced-out, rotting teeth. At this point, he was being called the Valley Intruder and the Walk-In Killer, depending on which news outlet you got your stuff from.
See, there's where we started with the initial ones. And, on March 27th, 1985, Ramirez actually entered a home that he had burglarized a year earlier. So he had already been in this home and stole some stuff, went back to it, and this was right outside of Whitner, California, at approximately 2 a.m. He killed, it was Vincent Charles Zazira, that was 64 years old while he slept.
You see, you
put a .22 handgun to his head and pull the trigger while the guy slept.
Women and old men. Like, you can't go up against anybody who could defend himself.
Yeah, it woke his wife up whenever he pulled the trigger.
No.
But Ramirez didn't shoot her. He ended up beating her, bound her hands up, and demanded to know where any valuables were. While he ransacked the room, Maxine escaped her bounds. So she got out of the where her hands were together.
Yeah, good for Maxine.
Retrieved a shotgun from under the bed.
Uh-oh.
He got the shotgun away from her.
No.
And,
of course, I guess we wouldn't be calling this to tell the Night Stalker.
That's right, because the shotgun wasn't loaded at the time. He fired 3 rounds into her. Then he fetched a big carving knife out of the kitchen. And he took the kitchen knife, and then he actually mutilated the body of the lady he just shot 3 times.
Yeah, it was said that he gouged out her eyes and placed them in a jewelry box, and he left that shit there on purpose.
Jesus Christ,
man!
And all the mutilations. It was post mortem. She was already passed.
Just sick. Just sick.
God, this is one of the worst human beings. Ever. He was the devil, is what I consider it.
And then after that, on May 14th of 1985, he returned back to Monterey Park and entered the home of Bill Doy, a 66-year-old man, and his disabled wife Lillian, who was 56.
This just gets worse.
You're not a predator. You're not a stalker. You're preying on the weak. He surprised Doy in his bedroom, and Ramirez shot him in the face with that freaking .22 as Doy went for his own handgun. Man!
And I'm going to tell you, .22 is not the caliber to be shot with.
No.
Because it just bounces around.
Yeah.
You as an EMT, you know like I'm talking
I've
about.
Seen a couple small caliber
It literally enters, and it doesn't have an exit, and it just bounces around.
Yeah, Ramirez entered Lillian's bedroom. He bound her with thumb cuffs, of all things. And he raped her, and he ransacked her homes for valuables. Now, I believe I have some pictures, or at least a picture of the thumb cuffs. And when we make sure the story goes live on Facebook and Instagram, I will include that as well.
Are they like finger locks, or what are thumb cuffs?
They're like, think of steel handcuffs, but shrink them down for the thumbs. It's not like a Chinese finger thumb where, you know, it's
out. Yeah, no,
like
these are actual handcuffs for your thumbs.
Actual cuffs for your thumbs.
So, I mean, you try to move your, I mean, you're just cutting into your thumb the whole time you're trying to get out of it.
They have the serrated kind of edge deal that goes with it.
Oh, my gosh, dude.
It doesn't sound fun. Bill Doyle died of his injuries while at the hospital. He didn't make it either. Jeez. On the night of May 29th, 1985. So, I mean, barely 2 weeks later. Not even 2 weeks later, Ramirez drove a stolen, he stole a car and drove it to a place called Monrovia. He stopped at the house of Mabel Maubell, age 83. Now, come on, man. And her disabled sister, another disabled woman, Florence Nettie Lang, age 81. So you got Maubell and Nettie Lang, two sweet old ladies. And this fool grabs a hammer that was in the kitchen. He beat and bound Lang while she was in her bedroom, and then beat and bound Bill before using an electrical cord to shock the women. He then raped Lang while he used Bell's lipstick to draw a satanic pentagram symbol on her thigh as well as the walls of the bedroom. The women weren't found for multiple days. They were alive but in a comatose state, and Miss Bell later died of her injuries. Poor women. Now, I will say, during the Netflix documentary, this is some of the crime scene photos that turned me off to watching it really much farther, because they were glorifying really what happened. And the detective, and I know the detective that did this, you know, he meant well, but his eyes were just bright, and he was so excited to be sharing this information and show these pictures, and it was just a big turnoff to
me. I couldn't do it, man. The documentary went so fast, and I tried, and I don't listen to a lot of podcasts, especially on the subjects when we're doing something.
Oh, yeah, me either.
I will try to watch a couple of documentaries to get some idea, but most of this, honestly, a million different news articles, wiki pages, whatever we can find. Yeah. And but yeah, when I was trying to watch it, though, it went super quick, and it skipped over why he was who he was and everything else. I mean, it almost glorified him, like you said.
It really expected you to know who he was, and to me, that gives him too much credence, you know, and credit.
Yeah, and you know, the whole time when he's doing this stuff, he actually lived in what was called the Cecil Hotel. Do you know what the Cecil Hotel is?
Oh, yeah, we're going to get into the Cecil Hotel later, man. I won't give it away just yet, though.
But you know, he was there during this stuff, and that's what,
that's crazy. Now, yeah. The very next day, Ramirez drove the same car that he had stolen to Burbank, and he snuck into the home of a lady who was named Carol Kyle, and Miss Kyle was 42 years old. Now, holding her at gunpoint, he bound her and her 11-year-old son together with handcuffs and then ransacked their house. He released Kyle, and was getting him to direct him to where the valuables were, where he then raped her repeatedly afterwards.
Jesus.
Now, yeah, Ramirez reportedly ordered her not to look at him, and telling her that he was going to cut her eyes out.
Which we know he will.
Yeah, there's already been evidence, and I'm sure they had gone around in the media. So, you know, he was serious. He fled the scene, and she retrieved her son from the closet and the binding, and, you know, he was out of there. So, luckily, she didn't die, and neither did the boy.
But my goodness, though, what she went through, that kid went through.
Yeah.
And, man, on July 2nd of 1985, he actually drove a stolen car to Arcadia and randomly selected the house of Mary Louise Cannon. She was 75 years old and a widowed grandmother. I do not like this guy.
Dude, I know. I keep trying to be funny, but this just isn't funny, man.
And, after he entered Cannon's home, he found that she was actually asleep in her bedroom. He bludgeoned her into unconsciousness with a lamp and then repeatedly stabbed her using a butcher knife that he found in her kitchen.
So he uses weapons of opportunity besides his favorite 22 caliber handgun.
Yo, dude, he had no rhythm. There was no pattern. The only pattern is older people, younger people, kids. I mean, this guy had there was no pattern to him whatsoever.
Yeah.
But he was so stupid, it left trail everywhere he went so they could put them together.
He was the night stalker. I am death.
Yeah, bullshit.
A normal detective and a normal profiler, for the most part, especially in this, you know, in that day and age, because, you know, Los Angeles was crazy then, they wouldn't have put one, you know, two and two together. But he left a paper. He left a trail everywhere he went.
So July, he really turns things up. And I want Daniel
How
to carry
his. How do you turn this up? My goodness.
But he does in the frequency. And I want you to really dive into July and let these folks know what's going on.
Yeah. So that was July 2nd when he did that and actually killed the 75-year-old. But July 5th, so I mean just a couple of days later. Yeah, he actually broke into another home and bludgeoned a 16-year-old Whitney Bennett with a tire iron as she slept. This poor 16-year-old is asleep, and he walks in and just starts hitting her in the head with it. Believe it or not, though, even though she got bludgeoned with his tire iron, dude, she actually survived the attack.
No way.
He went through the house trying to find a knife. He was looking for whatever he could, and he wanted to stab her, though. But he couldn't find anything. He went back with a telephone cord. By the way, for those under the age of 20, a telephone cord, actually, there was a phone on a wall at one time in your home, and the cord went into the wall. He takes it.
We're having to explain to our younger audience what a telephone cord is.
That's where we're at. And he wraps it around her neck, and he's strangling her, right?
Oh, man.
Right before she actually passes, he starts seeing sparks. How a telephone cord has sparks, I'm not sure. But he claimed he'd seen sparks and thought that Jesus himself had come and was saving this girl's life and had intervened into this attack. Well, and that is the only reason that girl survived.
I guess if you have such a big belief in the devil, you got to have a big belief in Jesus as well.
That's right. It goes one way, it goes the other.
Yeah.
And but believe it or not, and I mean, you're talking, dude, it actually like split her head into a million pieces.
Oh.
There was almost 500 stitches and staples to put her face and head back together.
Dude, that is crazy.
500.
But amazing that she was able to make it out and survive.
That's right. But you know what? He wasn't done yet.
No.
2 days later.
Just 2 days later?
July 7th, 1985. He actually burglarized the home of Joyce Lucille Nelson. She's 61 years old. My mama's like that same age, and I don't like that.
Man, you just told your mama's age? Yeah. You might want to edit this real quick.
Yeah. We're doing post-edit. But
hey, Mom.
He walked in. He actually broke in, found her completely asleep in the living room on the couch, and he beat her to death using his own fist and then kicking her in the head, pretty much curb-stomping her.
Oh, way.
And a shoe print was from an Avia shoe sneaker was actually imprinted in her face. And then he cruised two other neighborhoods and returned back to Monterey Park and chose the home of Sophie Dickman, age 63. So not one, but two. He actually assaulted and handcuffed Dickman at gunpoint, attempted to rape her, stole all of her jewelry, and then swore to him that he, you know, and she swore, you have everything of value, you have everything of value.
Yeah.
And he said, swear to Satan.
What a putz. Swear to Satan.
He's like, dude, it sounds like he has the mental capacity of like a 13-year-old.
He should be drooling and stuff.
It's almost like he was so delayed. I mean, he comes off as like a 13-year-old. He really does.
I agree with you. I agree with you.
And I swear to Satan. What an idiot. Dude, so just a few days later, July 20th, Ramirez purchased a machete, and then he was driving a stolen Toyota to Glendale. He chose the home of Leela Needing.
Sorry, it's my bad handwriting, guys.
Yes. Age 66. She was 66 years old, and her husband was 68. He burst into the sleeping couple's bedroom, hacked them with the machete that he had just bought, then killed them with shots to the head from a .22 caliber. He further mutilated their bodies with a machete before robbing everything out of the house of any kind of value. And then quickly, he went and sold this stuff down the road at a pawn shop before driving to Sun Valley.
Probably to pay for his stay at the Cecil.
That's right. At a, oh, my God, at that hotel. At approximately, like, 4 a.m. or so, he breaks into this next house right after the last one, shoots the husband as he's sleeping in the bed, takes the lady, binds her up, takes an 8-year-old kid, ties the 8-year-old kid up, a little boy, he rapes and beats the lady, drags her through the house, making her show him where everything of any kind of value is. Before he leaves the house, he looks down at her. Guess what he says?
What's that?
Swear to Satan that you won't tell anybody, and this is all.
Yeah. And if you're wondering why there were no names listed during that little tidbit, It's because we couldn't pronounce them. Sorry. But moving on, August 6, 1985, it's when Ramirez drove to Northridge, and he broke into the home of Chris and Virginia Peterson. He slowly snuck into the bedroom, and he startled Virginia, and he shot her in the face with the .25 caliber semi-automatic handgun at this time. He then shot Chris in the neck and tried to get away, but Chris fought back while avoiding more gunshots that were heading his way during the struggle with Ramirez. But Ramirez managed to get away and escape.
But luckily, they survived their injuries, and I mean, they made it.
Yeah, absolutely. On August 8th, 1985, Ramirez drove a stolen car, which is his MO by now, to Diamond Bar, California, and chose the home of Sakina Abawath. I hope I got that right. Age 27, and her husband, Elias Abawath, who was 31 at the time. Sometime around 2:30 in the morning, he snuck into the house, and he made his way into the master bedroom. He instantly and immediately killed the sleeping Elias. Shot him one time in the head. He handcuffed and beat Sakina while forcing her to tell where the family's jewelry and other valuables were. He then raped her as well. He repeatedly demanded that she swear to Satan and that she would not scream during his assaults. But then the couple's 3-year-old son came into the bedroom. Ramirez tied up the child and then continued to rape poor Sakina. After that, he left the home. Sakina untied her son and sent him to the neighbors for help.
Jesus Christ.
Now,
it's in the history, man. He's just repeating himself at this point.
Yeah.
Even though he's not targeting these people specifically, he is kind of looking for Asian Americans.
Yes, he is.
And then on top of that, the age, though, doesn't really matter. And so his demographic is basically anybody that's at their home asleep.
Yeah, crime of opportunity.
So you can think, like, if you lived there at the time, could you imagine how worried people must have been, like, just to go to sleep?
Yeah. And you can believe this guy was feeding off of the media coverage of his crimes.
Oh, of course.
He left Los Angeles and then headed to San Francisco. On August 18th, 1985, he entered the home of Barbara and Peter Pan. That's right. He shot the sleeping Peter, who was 66 years old, in the temple with that .25 caliber handgun. He then beat and sexually assaulted Barbara, age 62, before shooting her in the head and leaving her for dead. Now, at the crime scene, Ramirez once again used lipstick to draw a pentagram, and this time he wrote the phrase, "Jack the Knife," on the bedroom wall. I have no idea what that means. If anybody does, send us a message. Let us know. When it was discovered that the ballistics and the shoe print from these crime scenes in Los Angeles also matched the scene in San Francisco of the Pan murders, they then began to start forming up everything. And San Francisco's mayor, Dianne Feinstein, led a televised press conference. She leaked a lot of information, and it really pissed some detectives off. But they knew that he was following it, and they kept on going.
Well, they were probably afraid he was fixing to bounce town or head to Mexico or something.
Yeah, they didn't want him to go. Now, Ramirez, who had been watching the press, absolutely, got rid of his size 11.5 Avia sneakers, and he tossed them over the Golden Gate Bridge at night. He remained in the area for a couple more days before he returned to Los Angeles.
Right. Well, the important thing about these sneakers was the fact that there was only a handful of them even made or sold.
Yeah, in that area, in some certain size and widths, it was only about 5 pair or something. It was very convenient.
So it was easy to narrow down. I don't think they ever found out exactly where the shoes were purchased originally.
Ah.
Like where he bought them at, but okay. The shoes kind
of
gave them away.
Yeah. On August 24th of 1985, Ramirez headed south for 76 miles, and he was in a stolen orange Toyota.
Again.
Yeah. He must have been easy to get into Toyotas back then. Now, his destination was Mission Viejo. That night, he arrived at the home of James Romero Jr., who had just returned from a vacation in Mexico. Romero's son, 13-year-old James Romero III, was awake, and he heard Romero's footsteps outside the house. Whoa. Now, thinking that there was a prowler, which, I mean, good for James. James went to go wake up his parents, and bitch tits left the scene.
Yeah, he's gone.
Yeah. James raced outside and got a description of the make, color, model of the car, as well as a partial license plate number. I mean, good for these people. Romero then contacted the police and gave all the information.
Right, but it was a stolen car.
Yeah, yeah. So. Now, after this encounter, Ramirez broke into the house of Bill Carnes, who was 30 years old at the time. Bill also had a fiance, Inez Erickson, who was 29. And he broke in through their house through a back door. They were asleep, and he awakened Cams when he cocked his .25 caliber handgun. He shot Cams 3 times in the head before turning his attention to Erickson. He then told the woman, who was scared out of her gourd at that time, that he was the Night Stalker and forced her to swear to Satan as he beat her with his fist and then tied her up with neckties and tossed her in the closet. He stole what he could. He began to drag Erickson around, you know, for other parts of the house out of the closet, and then began to rape her again. He demanded cash and more jewelry, made her swear to Satan some more, and right before he left the home, he said, "Tell them the Night Stalker was here."
I'm telling you, the dude's like a 13-year-old jerk. Like, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
But Erickson, grow up, dude.
Yeah, she was a true hero, man. She untied herself, managed to gain her composure, went to a neighbor's house with and got help. Surgeons removed 2 of the bullets from her fiance's head, and he survived his injuries.
Jesus Christ. Yeah.
She gave a very, very detailed description of Ramirez, and they obtained a cast of his footprint from their home. His stolen Toyota was found abandoned on August 28th in Wilshire Center, Los Angeles, and the police were able to get a fingerprint from the rearview mirror, so he wasn't careful enough. The print was positively identified as belonging to Ramirez, and he was described as a 25-year-old drifter from Texas with a long rap sheet that included many arrests for traffic and illegal drug violations. Police began to release a mugshot of Ramirez from a December 12, 1984 arrest for auto theft to the media, and finally, the Night Stalker had a face. At the police press conference, it was announced, "We know who you are, and soon everybody else will. There will be no place for you to hide."
You know, and the whole time, man, oh my gosh, like, the fact that women idolize this guy or have any kind of romantic attachment to him whatsoever based off of looks is the most shallow thing I could ever think of. Like, I just don't see it, man.
Yeah. Oh, and speaking of his looks, I forgot to tell you guys, our sponsor for the episode, man, it's Danny's Discount Dentistry, where you get one tooth, we pull 3. Just saying.
That's it. Well, also, man, our guys over at Blue Bikes. And, man, Shannon and his family put together this little place right here in Monroe. So if you're listening to this, you haven't been in the Monroe area, man, go check him out. He repairs bicycles, builds a lot of stuff. Cool guy, man.
Yeah. One more quick segment from our sponsors, and we're going to get back and tell you guys about the capture of the Night Stalker and give you an account of a very detailed interview from one of the people who helped bring this man in. All right, guys, we're back. We appreciate that. Big shout out to Anchor for sponsoring us. On August 30th of 1985, Ramirez traveled by bus to Tucson, Arizona to visit his brother. Now, he was not aware at this time that every freaking newspaper article and major television news story was about him. He didn't get a chance to meet up with his brother, so then he returned to Los Angeles early in the morning of August 31st. He walked directly past some police officers who were staking out this bus terminal in hopes of catching this man. How flagrant can you be?
Well, you got to think of the day and age, man. We're talking early, mid-80s. So even if they got an image of the guy, it's probably this grainy-ass picture. I mean, you fax it over, you didn't have, you couldn't just easily email it and have a colored photo.
No, absolutely, man. Absolutely.
So, I mean, but on the same note.
Yeah. Then a group of elderly women started identifying him and screaming out, El Matador, El Matador, which translates into the killer. Ramirez saw his face on the front page of the newspaper rack next to him and then freaked out and ran. At this point, I'm going to turn it over and we're going to get an excerpt from the interview from the guys that captured this man. Now, as he was running and being chased, we're going to get into this. It's quoted as being said, I ran to defend her, and he told me, don't get closer as I shoot you. Guy said, I didn't see a gun, so I opened the door and pulled him out of the car, says Jose Berguin. And he recalled that. Now, Manuel de la Torre showed up with a steel rod to defend his wife. He smashed Ramirez on the head, sending Ramirez running. Berguin yelled for his two sons, who had come out of the home after hearing the commotion, to not let him escape. Julio Berguin, I hope I'm not messing that up too much, guys, who was 45, said he remembered chasing Ramirez with his brother and bringing him down and making him sit on the curb. The neighbors made sure Ramirez didn't get up, though he begged him to let him go, claiming that some guys were chasing him. He was saying, let me go, let me go, come on, let me go, Julio recalled. He said, I said, no, you're not going anywhere. It was only moments later that people began to realize who they had captured. People started coming out saying, that's the killer, but in Spanish, El Matón, El Matón. And then the crowd began to beat Ramirez, and he was saved by the police, y'all. Saved by the police.
Oh, they was going to get him.
Yes.
Should have went ahead and saved everybody a lot of headache and time. But, you know, they really wanted to find out if he had done any more of this. I mean, you really want to know who all the victims are. They brought him to justice,
you know?
Yeah, I mean, you want to know who all the victims are. That's it. But, I mean, personally, I would have probably beat the holy living snot out of this guy. Never stopped. But, you know, the trial and stuff got even, I mean, it was just as crazy as insane.
Yeah, but tell us about the trial, dude.
Man, so in July of 1988, they actually started the they started handpicking, you know, the jury.
Okay.
At August 14th, the trial got interrupted. One of the jury members didn't show up for jury duty.
Why didn't they show up?
She was found dead in her apartment.
What?
And, so at first, detectives thought that somehow Ramirez had convinced somebody to go and kill this jury to mess the trial all up. What actually ended up happening, though, was that her boyfriend had actually killed her the night before. And so that set the whole trial all kinds of crazy. And then it was like him in the middle of the courtroom. He literally drew like a pentagram on his hand and was just holding it up and yelling Satan and stuff. And the guy doesn't come off as, I mean, I hate to say it, does come off as crazy. He comes off as just really immature and slow.
Yeah. On September 20th, 1989, Ramirez was convicted on all charges. They were 13 counts of murder, 5 counts of attempted murder, 11 counts of sexual assault, and 14 counts of burglaries. During the penalty phase of the trial, which happened on November 7th, he was sentenced to die in California's gas chamber. He stated to reporters after the death sentence, "Big deal. Death always went with the territory. See you in Disneyland."
Jesus.
Oh, what a jerk. The trial cost $1.8 million, which translates to roughly $3.75 million in today's terms, which at the time made it the most expensive case in the history of California until the O.J. Simpson murder trial.
But, you know, man, when he was doing all these murders, and it was a lot of rapes that were in there at the same time, and that wasn't linked to the murders. I mean, he literally raped children over and over. I think we spoke about one, but there was multiple children that he had raped. And then all these, and he was an opportunist. Any chance he would get, he would take. But he was staying at this place called the Cecil Hotel all the time, and here's what tripped me out. He would get done with raping and murdering, go back to the hotel, and this is how ran down and crazy that part of town was. Strip completely naked in the alley behind the hotel, throw his bloody and muddy clothes into a dumpster, and walk butt naked or in his underwear through the hotel like nothing happened and nobody even blinked an eye.
Oh, man.
Think of how close he was to being caught if people just cared.
Think about how wild that place was. Just a naked dude running through the halls was just normal.
Yeah, and he stayed on the top floor, and there was in the 90s, I can't remember his name. There was another serial killer who almost wanted to be a copycat of Ramirez, and he actually stayed in the same hotel as well.
Man.
But the hotel had a history ever since it was first founded of just odd happenings, murderers. I mean, you name it, it happened at that hotel. But that was the Cecil Hotel. It's a really cool read if anybody wants to look it up.
Yeah. So the Night Stalker finished his life out in prison.
Yep. He did get married.
Yes. I guess we should talk about this freaking romantic relationship, since we made a big deal about how we cannot see how some of these ladies like this man. I just don't understand it.
I am not one for physical violence on women by any means whatsoever. But if somebody wants to go slap the mess out of that lady, I 100% do not bother, blame them.
I'm going to pull this and just tell you guys straight off Wiki. So by the time of the trial, Ramirez had fans who were writing him letters and paying him visits. Beginning in 1985, Doreen Loy, I believe, wrote him nearly 75 letters during his incarceration. By 1988, Ramirez proposed to Loy. And on October 3rd, 1996, they were married in San Quentin State Prison. For several years before Ramirez's death, Loy stated that she would commit suicide when Ramirez was executed. But she left him in 2009 when DNA evidence confirmed that he was the one who had raped and murdered poor little 9-year-old Mae Lung. Now, by the time of his death in 2013, he was engaged to another woman, a woman by the name of Christine Lee, who was a 23-year-old writer. So I believe she was trying to get something out of that. But she could have been really, really upset. Let's see. He tried to appeal a few times. Nobody gave a crap about that. He doesn't give a crap. The main thing in jail, you guys should know, was that every Tuesday he was giving the pitchfork. And what the pitchfork is three wieners at the same time, right up the back booty hole. And that's what his Tuesday was like in jail.
Yeah, thanks to the way our great system works, he would have actually been in his 70s or older before they even executed him. But he ended up passing away at 53 of natural causes. So a guy that inflicted so much harm went out that easy.
Rotted away in jail.
Yeah, it ended up being, it was like he had hep C and stuff from all the drug use, surprisingly. And that's how he went out.
He got hep C from the devil's pitchfork. I'm telling you.
That's right. Oh, yeah.
Triple wiener. So, guys, that was Ramirez. Let us know what you guys think. Facebook, Lost in Thought. Instagram, Stay Lost in Thought. YouTube, Stay Lost in Thought Media. There's a bunch of them, guys. And make sure you support us on Anchor.
That's right. Anchor's where it's at, man. They've helped us out a lot with this.
Yeah. So over there on the other side is Daniel. I'm Josh. The great Tolkien once said, not all who wander are lost. Till next time, stay lit.
I think most humans have in them the capacity to commit murder. It is not because...
No, we don't, Richard.
They choose not to, not because they are morally superior, as they so commonly claim, but because they are imprisoned in a web of responsibilities, commitments, beliefs, and sentiments.
Richard.
And that would render murder...